rotund rear protruded as he rifled through the kitchen garbage bin.
"Nothing in here but rubbish,"
Kirby's voice gurgled, a large unlit cigar hanging from his lips, his bushy mop of hair like an antennae on top of his head. He grinned at Lottie. She scowled. Larry Kirby was divorced and currently cavorting with the 20-something-year-old actress in town. More luck to him, she thought. At least it might stop his flirtatious glances at her. Despite all that, Kirby was called the lovable rogue within the force.
"Put away that cigar," she ordered.
His face reddened, and he put the cigar into his breast pocket, grunting loudly. He opened the fridge and inspected the contents.
"And make sure the neighbours are canvassed," Lottie instructed.
"We need to determine when Sullivan was last seen."
"Right away,"
Kirby said, slamming the fridge door shut and stomping off to give the order to someone else. Lottie could see what Lynch had been talking about. Dirty dishes piled high in the sink. A pot with potatoes, half of them peeled on the table. An open sliced pan. A jam pot with a knife protruding from it and white mould circling the rim. A bowl, encrusted with the remains of porridge, sat in the midst of the mess. It was difficult to determine if the woman had just had breakfast or dinner. Maybe both together. The floor was dirty, crumbs and dust everywhere. "The sitting room is worse," Lynch said. "Have a look." Lottie turned out of the kitchen, followed her colleague's pointed finger and stood at the door.
"Holy shit," she said.
"Good God,"
Boyd said. "Agreed," Lynch said. There were hundreds of newspapers stacked in every conceivable space in the room, on the floor, the armchairs, the couch, and on top of the television. Some were yellowing, and others appeared to have been shredded by a mouse. The room was dust-covered. Lottie picked up a paper from the nearest bundle, December 29th. Susan had been working her way outwards. Lottie began counting the newspapers in her head. "Some mountain of rubbish in here," she said. "Must be at least a couple of years' worth." "This woman had serious issues," Lynch said from behind her. Lottie shook her head. "I can't marry this scene with the absolute tidiness of her office. It's like she was two different people."
"You sure you got the right house?" Boyd queried. Two sets of eyes glared at him. "Only asking," he said, and slouched up the stairs, dipping his head beneath the low ceiling.
"Keep looking," Lottie said to Lynch. "We need to locate her phone. It'll give us her contacts and maybe information as to who wanted to kill her. I don't see any sign of a laptop or computer."
"I'll look for them."
"The suckers are almost done here," Detective Maria Lynch squeezed back into the crowded kitchen. Lottie followed Boyd upstairs. He was in the bathroom.
"Pills for everything, from a pain in the arse to a pain in the elbow," he said.
He sounded like her mother. She pushed him out of the way and peered into the medicine cabinet. Sullivan should have been on suicide watch, she thought, eyeing packets of Prozac, Xanax and Temazepam. "Looks like she wasn't taking her medicine," she said, quelling the urge to pocket a few blisters of Xanax. Jesus, she could function for at least 3 months on this lot.
"Because there's so much still here," he asked.
"Yeah. Oxycontin too."
"What's that?"
"Morphine," said Lottie, remembering her own medicine cabinet before Adam died. She checked the prescription details, recording the pharmacy name in her phone to follow up later. She looked around the bathroom. It was filthy. She edged out past Boyd and entered the bedroom.
"In here,"
she called. He joined her.
"Incredible."
What was going on in this woman's head? In her life? Lottie asked. The bedroom was sparkling clean, sterile, nothing out of place. The bed, dressed to army standards in pure white, clean linen. A dresser, naked of any cosmetics. Wooden floor, shining. That was it. "I can almost see myself in the floor," she said, and opened the dressing table drawer. Everything was folded with military precision. She closed it again. Someone else's job to desecrate the belongings of the dead. She wouldn't do it. Not after Adam. This woman was a contradiction.
And she lived alone,
Boyd said, checking the other bedroom. Lottie glanced over his shoulder. It was bare. Four white walls and a wooden floor. She shook her head in confusion. Susan Sullivan was definitely an enigma. Downstairs, she looked around again. Something didn't gel. What was she missing? She couldn't quite draw her thoughts to a conclusion. She had to get out. Boyd joined her outside, a cigarette between his fingers.
Where to now?
He asked, taking a deep pull on the cigarette. Lottie gladly inhaled the smoke and yawned.
I better go home and feed my kids.
They're teenagers, well able to look after themselves, he said.
You need to look after yourself.
A statement that did not require a reply. It was the truth.
I have to digest this case. I want to pull together the few facts we have to see if I can make sense of it all. I need space.
And you'll get that at home?
Don't be smart.
She felt his closeness. Not just bodily close, but in mind. Boyd unnerved her. Conversely, she would love to feel his arm around her in a comforting hug. In the same instant, she knew she would repel it. Welcome to the world of frosty Lottie Parker. Her mood just about matched the weather.
There's nothing else we can do this evening. I'm going to walk. I'll see you in the morning. Remember, team meeting at 6 a.m. Corrigan will be there, so don't be late.
Redundant words, she thought. Boyd was never late. She trudged along the icy footpath towards home, alone. Chapter 6. The Governor's House, a 19th century building adjoining the new council offices, had once been part of the old town jail. The fact that it had access to the new offices was unknown to the Gardaí currently cordoning off the main building. In the depths of the house, dungeons had been preserved and were used as meeting rooms. Few staff ventured down there. Rumour had it that those awaiting death had spent their last hours within the walls, walls which reportedly pulsed with the breaths of condemned souls. The history of the building was not lost on the men gathered in one of the catacomb dungeons. They stood in a circle like condemned prisoners awaiting a stay of execution. This afternoon a member of the planning department, Susan Sullivan, was killed in suspicious circumstances, the official said.
It is regrettable. Terrible, actually. For us, it will be a tense time. The Gardaí will more than likely go through her files line by line. You need to be aware that your names may come up in the course of their investigation, and it's likely you will be interviewed.
He paused, looking at the three men in front of him.
If our dealings become known, we could well be seen as murder suspects, he added.
At least her knowledge died with her, the developer said. But the investigation will swing the spotlight on us.
The banker visibly shivered. If anything, the temperatures had dropped since they arrived in the dungeon. The evening darkness outside seemed to penetrate through the walls.
There's still James Brown to think of, the banker said.
Without Sullivan, it's just his words against ours, the official said. However, you're right. I think we need to prepare the contingency plan in light of potential Garda interviews. We must maintain the appearance of working individually. They might not stumble over what we are doing.
He rubbed his hands together, trying to instill heat into his fingers.
Don't be fooled, said the developer. They're very shrewd, and we'll need to be more so. If it's Detective Inspector Lottie Parker leading the investigation, I can guarantee we'll need to be careful.
Do you know her?
Asked the banker. I've heard of her. She solved that traveller murder a few years ago. She was threatened and intimidated, but carried on, and she got her man. She'll be like a dog with a bone once she gets her teeth into this one.
The clergyman said nothing, and the official knew this man's calculating mind was internally analysing the situation. They huddled deeper into their wool coats, eyeing each other.
Gentlemen, there are millions of euro involved. We have to be very vigilant, and we can't meet here again. Be careful.
The official closed their meeting and opened the dungeon door. He glanced outside. A single light illuminated the deserted private car park. One by one they left, each of them now wary of the other. One of them could be a murderer. Chapter 7 James Brown parked his black Toyota Aventus in the courtyard outside his cottage, switched off the lights, took out the keys, and as the internal beam dimmed to darkness, he sat listening to the engine cool down. Normally he loved coming home after work, especially in springtime. Home to the serenity of the countryside, renewing his sense of well-being, with the sounds from the trees and glimpses of the meadows stretching untouched behind his small garden. It instilled in him a freedom he rarely felt elsewhere. Not now, though. This evening he was sad and angry. Sad for Susan, and angry at the rebuff he had suffered from the man on the phone. He'd contacted him to see what, if anything, he knew about Susan's death. But as he'd begun to speak, the man had hung up on him. Maybe he'd been the wrong person to call after all. He gripped the steering wheel with tight fists and banged his head against his hands. Susan was gone. He had to keep reminding himself. She'd rescued him from his demons all those years ago, and now he had failed her. He didn't want to leave the security of his car. He felt safe in it, and he thought of the many times he and Susan had cradled each other as children, she whispering in his ear to be strong, to stand tall and proud, and he whimpering like a lost kitten in her arms. He thought of how Susan, as a child, had shown him how to make his bed to the standards dictated, how to fold his clothes and pick fluff from the floor so that it was pristine. He was convinced that she had subsequently developed a thing about clean bedrooms. Who could blame her? He thought of all they had witnessed and never spoken about, and he cried silent tears for her memory and for her goodness to him. Now, he had to stand on his own two feet and be strong, for Susan, if nothing else. At last, he wheeled himself out of the vehicle as the temperature dissolved to ice. Lifting his briefcase from the back seat, he stepped onto the snow-blanketed courtyard and locked the car with a click. The old moon was getting ready for its new phase, and its light appeared dimmer than he thought it should be. A shadow fell before him, and he squinted upwards, expecting to see a cloud sheathing the moon. But there was no cloud in the frosty, starlit sky. A figure stood tall in front of him, a ski mask covering the face, two dark eyes visible. Jumping back against his car, James dropped his briefcase, then remembered his phone was inside it. Too late now.
What do you want?
His tongue tightened over his words, fear dripping down his face in droplets, along his nose, dribbling like snot.
What could he do? He couldn't think clearly.
You could not stop interfering, the man was saying, his voice a low, menacing drone.
James swung his head from side to side, wondering why he hadn't noticed the car when he'd pulled up. He now glimpsed a metallic glint beyond the oak tree to his right. Who was this man? How had he known he could shield his car over there?
What? Why?
James whispered, scuffing his feet on the icy snow and staring up at the huge figure looming in front of him. The flashlight in the gloved hand blinded him.
You and your friend made nuisances of yourself. Not for the first time.
My friend? James asked.
But he knew the man meant Susan. The man laughed, grabbed him by the elbow and propelled him along the path.
James felt a suffocating ball gathering mucus in his throat, and his breathing quickened as the sky clouded and snow began to fall in round, thick lumps.
What do you want?
James's fear quickly turned to terror, his brain constricting like a snail into its shell. He had to think fast. He needed to get control of the situation. He could call out for help, if only his voice wasn't lost somewhere deep in his chest. And he knew no one would hear him. There wasn't another house within 2 miles of his cottage. Maybe he should make a run for it. No. His attacker was taller, broader, and looked so much stronger, making James feel like an insect trapped in the jaws of a fly. Panic swelled and strapped itself squarely inside his chest, halting him after a couple of steps. He couldn't continue. He felt like he was walking with only one shoe on. The man stopped too, pulling a length of rope from his pocket. That did it. James leapt forward, surprising the man, who lost the grip on his elbow and fell, the flashlight lodging in a clump of snow. Skidding towards the front door, James searched with one hand in his pocket for the key. Ice crunched behind him. He had the key in the door when an arm slithered round his neck, gripped tight, and he was pulled back against a solid chest. James fought, managing to loosen the hold on his neck, but an elbow crashed into the back of his skull. His head exploded with pain.
You should not have done that.
He thought he knew the voice, struggled to recognize it, but failed. He turned quickly and tried to run, but felt the rope slipping around his neck, harsh nylon scraping his skin. This might be his last chance. He drew back his arm and connected with the man's midriff, but it bounced back. Pain shot through his elbow, up into his shoulder. The rope slackened and he collapsed to the ground. He turned over and scrambled to his knees. Run! He had to run! But he couldn't get his feet under him. He shouted then, as loud as he could from his terrified throat.
Help me! Help!
His voice sounded like someone else's echoing off the trees. The rope tugged tighter. He tried to dig his hands into the frozen earth. He tried to halt the pull. He tried to shout once more, but the rope was taut, biting into his skin, dangerously close to cutting off the air. What could he do?
Talk, he thought. I have to get him talking.
He ceased his resistance, but the man tightened the rope.
Come, the man said.
He steered James away from the cottage toward the oak tree with its branches casting demonic shapes on the whitewashed walls of the cottage. Beneath it, 2 wrought iron chairs, placed there for summer shade, looked out of place covered with mounds of snow.
What are you doing?
James said, when the rope eased slightly. The man threw one end of it into the air, looping it around a branch midway up the crusted bark. James prayed for a cloud to blot out the moon, to darken the garden into total blackness. With his eyes accustomed to the dusty light, he could see too much now, and his brain filled with irrational thoughts and flashing unframed pictures. One was an image of his mother, whom he never remembered having seen in his life. I'm going to die, he thought. He's going to kill me, and I can do nothing. His whole body convulsed in an unending trembling. He needed Susan. She always knew what to do. The man pivoted around, and James looked into the masked face, staring at the eyes waltzing a wicked dance to a silent tune, and he recognized them. Eyes he could never forget. Eyes he would always remember.
It was you! Susan! You, he said. I know you. I remember.
James struggled weakly, attempting to pull away, but each movement collided with the further twist of the nylon. Now he was remembering. Too late. He tried to form words to delay the man. The night of the candles. The belt.
You think you are clever. You were not always the smart one, were you? Back then, you had a girl to stand up for you. Not any more.
The voice was so clear it could cut the ice into shards. The eyes ceased gyrating. James frantically tore at the rope, pulling and jerking, scrunching his fingers under it, his stomach heaving with the strain. He couldn't breathe. He tried to wrench free. He kicked out with his legs, showering snow into the air. He had to survive. He had to get help. He had the rest of his life to live. In a desperate attempt to wrong-foot his opponent, he allowed his body to flop into a dead weight. How could the man heave him upwards then?
"Stand on the chair," the man commanded, swiping away a mound of snow with one sweep of his hand.
James stood still as if hypnotized, the rope furrowing a ridge into his neck, the man's body heat overpowering his senses. He tasted saltiness at the back of his throat. Two arms encircled his body and lifted him onto one of the garden chairs. The furniture legs sank into the snow, wobbled, then settled. Before James could jump back down, the man hauled the rope further round the branch. The snow fell faster and thicker. James swayed as the man stood on the other chair and knotted the rope.
"It would be a fitting destiny for you to swing from the apple tree, James. But its branches are not strong enough. This oak will do the job instead."
The rope was secure around the thick limb, midway up the bark. The falling snow darkened the moon, but its thin light still cast a yellow ray over the courtyard. The laden branches trembled with the additional weight, and James pleaded, moving his lips without sound. Before he could action further thoughts from his brain to his body, the man kicked over the chair and it settled into the snow-covered earth. As his chest ceased to inflate, his tongue protruded from purple lips. Blood leaked dots onto the whites of his eyes, and James saw the moon dance along the sky through a million white lights. He thought he could smell fresh apples, as his body swayed in the windless air, and his bowels opened. He heard the crunch of receding footsteps, before the white lights turned red, then black. A thick blizzard of snow tumbled earthwards. A sharp snowstorm of biblical proportions. The body paled, merging into its white surroundings. It cooled in death. Chapter 8 Rap music blared as Lottie opened her front door. Why did she let her kids listen to this trash? Because they'd listen to it somewhere else if she tried to stop them. Anyway, she couldn't monitor the hundreds of songs on their iPods and phones and online. Live and let live. "I'm home," she called over the din. No reply. The kitchen displayed the remnants of a teenage cook-in. Empty pot noodles, sticky forks on the table, and an open, half-full bottle of Coca-Cola. More than likely there since they had their breakfast at lunchtime. Boots, shoes and trainers were thrown inside the back door. Unopened Christmas cards stacked on the table and a few she had opened were wilting with condensation in the kitchen window. The tree was in the sitting room, out of her sight. She hadn't wanted to put it up. Sean had insisted. And now he'd have the job of dismantling the raggedy assemblage of tinsel and bowls. Tough. Lottie was glad all the false decor would soon be consigned to the attic. She hated, no, despised, Christmas since Adam died, over 3 years ago. Christmas was family time, but now her family was decimated. But still, she had great memories of the good Christmases. Adam and herself trying to construct a toy kitchen at 3 in the morning after demolishing a bottle of Bailey's. or waiting for him to come off duty from the army barracks on Christmas morning, Adam sneaking in before the children woke up, and she ticking off a list to make sure nothing was left in her mother's attic. One time they'd left an action man there, and Adam had to rush over and rouse her mother at 2 a.m. He called Lottie a coward. She smiled now at that memory. Adam wasn't afraid of her mother. Lottie wasn't either, but her mother had enough ammunition for rouse without Lottie arming her with more. That's what she told Adam anyway. She sometimes thought he loved her mother more than she did. His parents had died within a year of each other when he was just 18, so maybe he'd appreciated all that Rose did for Lottie and the children. But Lottie knew there was an old guilt lurking in Rose's actions, and no matter how hard she tried, she could never rid herself of that feeling. Every interaction she'd had with her mother since Adam died had resulted in a disagreement. Harsh words, old accusations and banging doors. Because of their last altercation, Lottie hadn't seen her mother in months, although she knew Rose called to see the children when she wasn't around. She tried her best for the children, but it was hard keeping your heart in it. It wasn't in a lot of things. When Adam died, a part of her had died with him. Cliché or not, it was the truth. If it were not for their children, well, she had the three of them. Life goes on. There were other long absences in her life to cope with also. The mystery of her father's death, and consequent saga surrounding her brother. She'd played the blame game all her life, but her grief for Adam overshadowed the decaying memories of the others, for now. Sean sauntered into the kitchen, tipping a ball on the end of a hurley stick. The boy loved hurling, one of the most vigorous national sports, though she wondered about how dangerous it was for her son. At 13 and a half years old, he was already as tall as Adam had been. His unruly fair hair masked long eyelashes. Lottie loved her son so much. Sometimes it made her want to cry. With Adam gone, she had to protect him, protect all of them, and the weight of that responsibility was sometimes an unbearable burden.
"What's for dinner, ma'am?"
Sean asked, pocketing the ball.
"Jesus, Sean, I'm only in the door. It's 7 o'clock. For once in your lives, couldn't one of you have cooked dinner?"
Her love quickly turned to frustration.
"I was studying."
"You were not. You didn't even open your bag, never mind a book."
"But we're still on holidays,"
said her sulky son. Lottie had forgotten, just for a minute. They'd been off school the last week, and would be for another long few days.
What did they do all day?
No, strike that. She didn't really want to know. Unsuspecting Chloe walked into the kitchen.
"Hi, Mother. What's for dinner?"
Chloe always called her mother. Adam had called her mother, in front of their children. She supposed her daughter was trying to keep him alive with these little things. Sean escaped back up the stairs, thumping his hurley on each step. The rap music restarted, louder this time. Chloe was dressed in a tracksuit bottoms, and a tiny strap top straining over her expanding, at last, according to Chloe, chest. Did she not realise it was sub-zero outside? Her long, bottle-dyed blonde hair, scrunched on top of her head, was held in place with a butterfly bobbin. Her bright blue eyes were an exact replica of her father's. The eyes Lottie had fallen in love with lived on, immortalised in her beautiful daughter. "The middle child," Chloe often threw at her when she felt the other two were being favoured.
"You're 16 years of age, Chloe. You're doing home economics in school. Would it never have entered your head to put on some dinner?"
"No, why should I? You come home and say I was doing it all wrong."
Point taken.
"Where's Katie?"
"Out, as usual."
Chloe opened a cupboard, looking for anything edible. Lottie went to the fridge. No wine. Shit. She didn't drink any more. At least, not as much as she used to, she reminded herself. Times like these, she missed alcohol most. It helped relieve the stress of the day. She didn't even smoke anymore. Well, maybe, sometimes, when she'd had a drink. God, but she was a contradiction. She should have taken a few Xanax from Susan Sullivan's medicine cabinet. But she would never do that. She didn't think she would, anyway. She kept a small supply in her bedside locker and had an emergency pill sellotaped to the bottom of her drawer in her office. Just in case, she told herself. And the stash was fast disappearing. "Put the kettle on, hon. I've had a bitch of a day," Lottie said. Chloe crunched a biscuit in her mouth and flicked the switch. The kettle hissed, empty.
"For God's sake," Lottie said.
Chloe was gone, the door swinging shut behind her. After pouring water into the kettle, Lottie snapped on the electric fire and sat into her chair, reclining it as far as it would go. Snuggled up in her jacket, she closed her eyes and eased the buzzing in her brain by breathing deeply. Chapter 9.
James Brown is dead.
What?
Lottie said into her phone. Sitting with the electric fire blazing heat at her feet, she glanced at the kitchen clock. 8:30. She'd been asleep for over an hour. It was only the phone that had awakened her.
"James Brown is dead," said Boyd. "You better get back to the station. Corrigan is dancing a jig. Sky News is reported to be on the way."
"Give me an old-fashioned traveller feud any day," Lottie said.
"You'll need a lift," Boyd said. "It's been snowing non-stop for the past few hours."
"I'll walk. It'll wake me up."
"Suit yourself."
She ended the call, searched for her jacket, discovered she was still wearing it, and shouted up the stairs.
"Chloe, Sean, I've got to go back to work."
No reply.
"You'll have to cook dinner yourselves."
A chorus greeted her.
"Ah, Mum! Leave money for a takeaway,"
shouted Chloe. She did. Sucker. Superintendent Corrigan was pounding up and down the corridor, ducking under ladders, swearing feck, head beetroot red, his permanent stressed-out colour. He turned around. Lottie came to a halt.
"Where were you? You should have been here,"
he said. "Sir, I did a 12-hour shift. I was at home." Corrigan turned around and stomped off to his office. Boyd and Lynch stood, jackets on, waiting. Kirby was nowhere in sight.
"What are you two looking at?"
Lottie asked. She had fire in her belly, but quelled it.
"Fill me in."
"A call came in half an hour ago," Maria Lynch said, curling her hair on top of her head before pulling on a knitted hat. "James Brown was found hanging from a tree at his home. Reports from uniform suggest it's a suicide."
"Suicide be arse," Lottie said.
"The same day his colleague is murdered?
God almighty.
When was the last time we had a murder, let alone two?"
"Memory man," Boyd said.
"3 years ago, when Jimmy Coyne killed Timmy Coyne in a family feud, you nailed him."
"It was a rhetorical question," Lottie said.
"Where's Larry Kirby?"
She glanced around. The incident room throbbed with activity. Maps of the town coloured the bare walls. Reports were building up in trays and detectives were busy on the phone. Buttoning up his jacket, Boyd said,
"No doubt Kirby's hanging out in a pub with his actress girlfriend."
"Are you jealous, Boyd?" Lottie asked. Lynch said,
"I'll go start up the car. It's probably frozen solid."
She escaped.
"You look like shit," Boyd said.
Lottie said,
"And I love you too.
Come on."
6 kilometres outside Ragmullen, the forest road was lit up with the flashing blue lights of 2 squad cars. The roads were almost impassable, and snow continued to fall heavier than it had since Christmas Eve, bulky flakes freezing as they fell. An ambulance and fire engine, wheels chained, blocked the narrow laneway leading to Brown's cottage.
"Fire engine?"
Lottie shook her head. Lynch just shrugged. Boyd abandoned the car and they walked the rest of the way along the tracks made by the other vehicles. Their legs sank to their knees as they trudged through the depths of snow. A gaunt, pale-faced man sat in a squad car, with two uniformed guardie, outside the inner crime scene tapes. Lottie was pleased with these precautions. A suspected suicide could easily be something else.
"Derek Hart," Garda Gillian O'Donoghue said, pointing to the man in the car. "He found the deceased. He's in a very distressed state."
"Talk to him, Lynch. Find out exactly who he is and why he's here. If it's something other than suicide, he's our number one suspect," Lottie said.
"There is a briefcase on the ground beside the deceased car," O'Donoghue said.
"Sockos can check it out when they arrive, then get it to the station." Lottie headed into the courtyard, Boyd beside her. A spotlight blazed eerie shadows towards a tree. She averted her eyes for a moment to concentrate on a paramedic standing against a snow-camouflaged car.
"You didn't cut him down?" she asked.
"No. I could see he was dead, and the man who found him was muttering about the victim knowing your woman murdered in the cathedral, so I thought I'd better call you guys, just in case, like." "I suppose you watch CSI," Lottie said. The man's face flushed. "You don't have to answer that," she added. "I got the fire crew to put up the spotlight. Pitch black out here in the sticks."
"Why the fire engine?"
"Haven't a clue," the paramedic said. "Can I smoke?"
"No,"
Lottie and Boyd said together. Turning away from the paramedic, Lottie looked up at the suspended body of James Brown highlighted by the temporary light. "I had a feeling Brown wasn't being totally honest with me today. If I'd pressed him, I could possibly have discovered something that might have saved his life.
Maybe he murdered Susan Sullivan and afterwards, full of remorse, hung himself," Boyd said.
"He murdered Sullivan? Would you look at him? A skinny 5 foot nothing, he couldn't kill a cold."
"In a fit of angry passion," ventured Boyd.
Lottie glared.
"You talk pure shite sometimes."
Brown's body swayed slightly in the snowy breeze. His head hung sideways, twisted towards her, eyes open wide, staring into nothingness. Lottie turned away from the body and slogged through the snow.
"What's wrong?"
Boyd asked.
"You look like you've seen a ghost."
"Maybe I have," she said. She stopped and looked around the scene. A chair lying on its side, partly submerged by the avalanche of snow. Briefcase on the ground beside the car and another car parked behind it. Then she noticed a key in the front door. Garda O'Donoghue was writing down whatever the paramedic had to say. Everyone had tramped through the site. Lottie doubted Sockos would find anything useful.
"Any suicide note?"
Lottie asked. O'Donoghue shrugged. "I scouted round when I got here, didn't see anything outside. Though, if there is a note, it's buried and saturated. Jesus, I haven't seen so much snow in all my life."
"Did the Hart guy go inside?"
Lottie asked, pointing to the key.
"Not that I'm aware of," O'Donoghue said.
Lynch popped up at Lottie's shoulder. "Hart says he's a friend of Brown and drove over to see him when he heard about Susan Sullivan's death."
"How did he know about Susan?"
"Brown phoned him. When he arrived, he saw the body straight away and called emergency. He was here staring up at Brown when our first car arrived. Didn't go near the house. So he says, anyway." Lynch swept away the clumps of snow, causing the ink to run in her notebook. "He's genuinely in an awful state. Will I get a car to take him home, or do you want to interview him tonight?" "I'm too tired to formulate proper questions. We'll bring him in for questioning in the morning," Lottie said. She spied an alarm box on the wall over the door.
"Ask him if he knows the alarm code."
"Do you want me to call in the morning too?"
asked the paramedic, a smile burning to his ears.
"Garda O'Donoghue has your statement," Lottie said. "Thanks for your help." "Oh, I nearly forgot," he said. "I found this stuck in the snow by the door."
Lottie looked at the man's gloved hand holding a small green flashlight.
"You picked it up?"
"I sure did," he said.
His eyes widened.
Oh, sorry. Maybe I should have left it there.
Maybe you should have. Lottie slipped the flashlight into a plastic evidence bag and snapped it shut.
Was it on or off?
I switched it off.
To save the battery.
She felt like thumping him and turned away before she did.
Shithead,
Boyd said under his breath as the paramedic retreated. Boyd, one of these days someone besides me is going to hear you and you'll get a broken nose. Get the suckos out here.
Her phone buzzed. Corrigan. The boss wants to see us in 15 minutes, she said.
Has that man seen the weather?
Back in town, standing outside the station, Boyd lit a cigarette. The snow eased slightly and frosty night air hijacked the smoke. Lottie wished she could have a drag, but it would be one too many. She never stopped at one of anything. Addictive personality disorder, her mother was fond of telling her. Thanks, ma'am. Stepping into the warm reception area, she checked her phone. No messages. No missed calls. She rang home. Chloe answered.
Hi, Mother. You coming home soon?
Not yet, Lottie said. I'm going into a meeting with my superintendent. Don't know how long I'll be. She rejected a pang of guilt. What could she do? She had to work, and this meant unpredictable hours.
Don't worry. We'll mind the house, Chloe said. Is Katie home yet?
Lottie was worried about her eldest child.
I think she's in her room.
Check to make sure.
Will do.
And tell Sean to turn off his PlayStation.
Of course. Chat later.
Chloe hung up. They'd be in bed when she got home. Well able to look after themselves. They would do okay, she hoped. She wasn't so sure about herself. Brushing snow off his shoulders, Boyd joined her.
Come on, he said. The superintendent awaits and we are late.
You took your time.
Corrigan marched up and down his office like a regimental sergeant.
Was it suicide or what?
He didn't wait for an answer.
Never mind anyway, it's suicide for now. One murder is enough for one day. Whatever it is, we'll get to the bottom of it. I don't want a hotshot team from Dublin taking over, so you better get your act together. Step up the door-to-door inquiries. There's people to be interviewed, phones to be manned, press releases, media briefs.
You're in your element, Lottie thought. I don't think James Brown killed himself, she ventured. Corrigan snorted.
And how do you arrive at that conclusion?
I think it feels too convenient, you know.
I don't know, he said. Enlighten me.
Lottie chewed her lip. How could she translate a gut feeling? Corrigan was career-minded and did things by the book. His favourite mantra regarding investigations was my way or no way. Lottie had another way. Her way. In any case, he didn't wait for her to answer.
Inspector Packard, what you think is irrelevant. Look at the evidence, the circumstances. He was hanging from a feckin' tree in the middle of the feckin' countryside in a feckin' blizzard. Something fishy's going on in that council. I can smell it here. He probably killed Susan Sullivan over some work thing. Found the guilt too much, so he swung her up over a tree and killed himself. Now let's plan our action.
Lottie withheld her words, and the three of them outlined the team's tasks. She was too exhausted to argue with Corrigan. When they had everything sorted as best they could, Corrigan repeated,
I don't want Dublin sending down hot shots. We can handle this. I want the Susan Sullivan murder solved pronto.
But sir, Boyd interjected, if it turns out we have two murders, won't we need the outside help?
Detective Sergeant Boyd, I've said what I've said. Into the matter. As of now, we have one suspicious death and a suspected suicide.
Corrigan's eyes slanted, defying them to argue. Lottie returned his gaze and pulled on her jacket.
Get a few hours sleep. Be back here at 6 a.m. sharp, he said.
They left the superintendent's office and walked down the corridor.
What the hell?
Boyd said, stopping abruptly. Lottie looked at him. He'd walked into a decorator's ladder and notched a cut on his forehead. She laughed. Boyd cursed his way out the door.
It's not funny.
I know, she said, but she couldn't stop laughing. Chapter 10 Lottie smiled to herself before she opened her front door. A bundle of Sean's Hurleys stood in the corner of the porch, and the holly wreath was caked in frozen snow, blown there by the wind. The wooden plaque on the wall beside the bell read Penny Lane. Adam had christened the house, each of the four bedrooms named after the Beatles. It seemed cute at the time. Now it was plain sad. She lived in one of the 30s semi-detached houses, midway along a mature, horseshoe-shaped estate. It was near enough to the Greyhound Stadium to hear the cheers every Tuesday and Thursday evening. But she never ventured the couple of hundred metres down the road to the track. Adam had taken the children a couple of times, but they weren't enamoured by the skinny dogs and their fat handlers. Tonight, the area was quiet. No racing until the ground was back in shape. Good, thought Lottie. She needed the peace and quiet. Silence greeted her as she hung up her jacket, the rap music consigned to Sean's virtual world. Having worked 18 hours, Lottie's body creaked, but her mind was wound up. In the kitchen, a plate with 2 slices of pizza was left out for her. Chloe had written a note. We do love you. She popped the pizza into the microwave and poured a glass of water. She loved her children, but usually didn't have the time to tell them. She saw so little of Katie. The 19-year-old commuted daily to college in Dublin. But even throughout the holidays, she was never around. She'd been the apple of her daddy's eye, and had been so moody since Adam died. Lottie didn't know how to handle her. Having devoured the soggy food, she climbed the stairs to her John Lennon bedroom. Chloe and Sean were in bed. She closed their doors and glanced into Katie's room, empty. She would have to have a talk with that girl. Tomorrow. Maybe. Katie Parker lay back into her boyfriend's arms. His hair tickled her nose. She tried not to sneeze and stifled a giggle. He appeared not to notice as he inhaled deeply from the spliff clutched between his long, thin fingers. When he'd filled his lungs, he passed it over. She shouldn't take it, but she desperately wanted to impress Jason. At 19, she should have more sense. Her mother would have a fit if she could see her. Tough shit, ma'am. Always pontificating about the dangers of drink and drugs. Maybe her mother should practice what she preached. Katie brought the rolled taper to her lips, inhaled its acrid odour before sucking deeply. She had expected a lightness in her head, but never had she experienced this thrill.
This is so cool, she said.
Take it easy. Jason rose onto his elbow. I don't want you puking all over me. She squinted up at the ceiling and saw little stars painted there. She assumed they were painted. Otherwise, she was hallucinating.
Do you have stars painted on your ceiling?
Yes. A throwback to my Harry Potter days.
I love Harry Potter,
Katie said.
All that mystical stuff. I used to wish I could magic myself into a different world. More so after my dad died.
Jason laughed. She glanced sideways at him. He was gorgeous, with his designer jeans and Abercrombie hoodies. She was so lucky. Today, when he had asked her to his home, she nearly died. Her house would fit into his sitting room. She was glad his parents were not around, because genuinely she would not have known whether to bow or genuflect. As for his room, it was fantastic. The size of hers, Chloe's and Sean's all scrunched into one. First year of college was a bore, but he'd picked her from all the other girls, She was floating.
Here, give me some, you greedy thing, he said.
She handed over the spliff, and though his arm was hard beneath her head, she could feel some of the softness of the pillow. She closed her eyes. Definitely floating. Yeah, if her mam could see her, she would have a grade A fit. I better go home, it's after midnight, she said, trying to sit up.
Are you Cinderella or what?
Jason laughed. Will I turn into a pumpkin if I don't get you home? Be serious. She sat up and felt around for her jacket.
All right, spoilsport, I'll take you home, he said.
Katie kissed him on the lips. Now she had wings. Sean Parker watched from his bedroom window as his sister and her boyfriend curled into each other on the snowy driveway. He witnessed them kissing under the road light and saw the smile on Katie's face. When had he last seen his gloomy sister so happy? He couldn't remember. Lottie eased her body into bed. She reached over her hand and felt the Argos book there, weighing down the duvet. Her trick, to keep the bedclothes tight on Adam's side. She had tried the phone book once, but it wasn't as good as the Argos book. She lay awake thinking of Susan Sullivan and James Brown, trying to understand what they could have possibly been involved in to warrant their deaths. Once she heard Katie turn her key in the door, she immediately fell asleep. Chapter 11. The man rubbed his skin in hard, even strokes. He had done what he had to do. Secrets had to be protected. He had to be protected. Others had to be protected too, though they didn't know it. He lathered his body, attempted to scrub out the scent of death. Slow and methodically he worked, from the roots of his hair to his neatly cut toenails. He stepped out of the shower and toweled his skin in precise sweeps. Fully dried, he strolled naked to his bedroom, lay down on the white sheets, and stared at the ceiling for the rest of the night. 1974. She knew what he was doing was wrong, but she was too afraid to tell anyone. He had a secret place where he took her most days after school. During the school holidays, he made her call to him at least once a week, and sometimes he came to her house. Her mammy was thrilled to have a priest coming to visit. She would take down the good china and serve him tea and biscuits. When her mammy was making the tea in the scullery, he would grab her hand and thrust it down there. She felt sick when he made her do that. It was nearly worse than the other things he made her do. Once, they were almost caught when her mammy came back in to see if he would like brown bread instead of biscuits. He turned towards the front window quickly, saying he was watching his car in case young hooligans scratched it. She did not see him for a month after that, and thought it was the end. But in fact, it was the beginning of the nightmare in earnest. He told her mammy he had a job for her in the evenings in the priest's house, sweeping and dusting, and he would give her a few bob pocket money. Her mammy was delighted. The little girl knew then the horror would be daily. Sometimes she drank her daddy's whiskey, which she found in the cabinet under the television. It burned her throat, but after a few minutes it warmed her insides and dimmed the reality around her. She was eating too much. Her mammy was giving out to her all the time about her weight. She wanted to tell her mammy to fuck off, because she had heard one of the girls in school saying it and knew it was a bad word. Sometimes the priest said bad words too when he was inside her. She hated him. She was sore and bleeding. She didn't like any of it. And she knew it was too late to stop it. Who would believe her? The girls in school were calling her fatty. Fatty this and fatty that. When she looked at herself in the mirror, she did not recognize the person staring back at her. She looked like Mr. Kinder, next door, with his beer belly sticking out through the buttons on his smelly shirt. Sometimes she cried herself to sleep. Mostly, she just hated herself and what she had become. What he had made her become. She vowed that some day she would make him pay. She did not know when or how, but one day his time would come and she would be ready. He had shown her no mercy, only contempt. She would be the same. What goes around comes around, she told her reflection in the mirror. Day 2, 31st of December 2014. Chapter 12. Lottie's car miraculously started on the second turn of the quay. Someone up there must love me, she told the dark early morning sky. She needed a clear head, so she drove the long way to work. Driving round by the Ardvale Road, she swung left at the roundabout, passing the once bustling tobacco factory with its smokeless chimneys. She remembered the pungent smell which used to hang in the air before the plant downsized to a distribution depot. She missed that whiff. It seemed to give definition to where she lived. It was gone now, like so much else. Stopped at the traffic lights on the Dublin Bridge, she took in the panoramic view of her snow-covered town below, nestled in a valley between two marshy midland lakes, dominated by the twin-spired cathedral to the right and the single spire of the Protestant church on the left. Cushioned between both stood a four-storey planning deformity apartment block, out of keeping with its low-rise surroundings. Historically, Ragmullen was a fortress town, but now its idle army barracks was a breeding ground for vandalism and rumoured to be in line to become a centre for refugees and asylum seekers. It was constructed on the highest point of the town, up beyond the canal and railway. The 11th century monks who'd settled here would be proud that some street still bore names in homage to these hooded men. There wasn't much else to be proud of, Lottie thought. Before the traffic lights changed, she scanned the horizon once again, her eyes focusing on the spires standing tall in their tree-lined surroundings. Her hands turned white as she clutched the steering wheel. She thought of the church's dominance over the lives of the townspeople in the past, and the effect its long-frocked men had bestowed on her own family. The cast-iron bell, snared in one spire, clanged out the sixth hour of the morning and resonated through the rolled-up windows of her car. There was no escaping it. Church and state. Two thorns in the history of Ragmullen and in her own history. Lottie took a few deep breaths and the shattered glass of the traffic light flashed to a crack green. She stamped down the accelerator and the car skidded, almost stealing a strip of paint from the red Micra in front of her, the only other car around. She drove over the bridge and down the icy potholed, deserted street with shop windows dark and shaded. She wondered how many secrets lay behind them, what mysteries waited to be uncovered, and if in time there would be anyone left in Ragmullen to even bother trying to unearth them. 30 men and women were crowded into a small instant room. Some sat on rickety chairs while others stood shoulder to shoulder, chatting loudly, body odours mingling with diverse perfumes, aftershaves and burned coffee. Lottie looked for somewhere to sit and, not finding anywhere vacant, leaned against the wall at the back of the room. She watched Corrigan fiddling with the handful of pages, standing in front of the assembled detectives. She should be up there. Boyd caught her eye and smiled. She grinned back. His smile could do that to her sometimes, just when she intended to scowl. Looking as neat as ever, dressed in a grey suit, his only concession to the weather was a navy sweater over his shirt. Perhaps this could be a be nice to Boyd day. Maybe. Maybe not. She gulped her black coffee, jolting energy into her tired mind, Corrigan nodded to her, and she hurried to the front of the room before he changed his mind. She faced the team. Kirby's eyes were red-rimmed, probably from